completely black. I wondered if it was shut. It looked dead. I peered at it. The dense blackness suddenly swelled and expanded, and for a moment I was afraid it would explode from its gilt frame, grow like the blob and swallow me up. But at the peak of its crest, it thumped loudly, made a squishing sound, and deflated. After a moment it swelled again, squished, deflated. I shuddered. It was a giant black heart hanging on the wall, pumping away. I moved on. The second mirror showed an empty bedroom. The third was open on a prison cell containing human children. They reached through the bars for me with bony, pale arms and imploring eyes. I froze. There were 100 of them or more crammed into the tiny cell. They were filthy and bruised with torn clothing. I had no time for this. I couldn't afford the emotion. I stepped closer to the mirror and turned my palm toward it to snap a picture, so that later, after I'd gotten my parents out, I could make Barron's help me find this place in the Silvers and free them. But just as I was about to press the button, one of the children opened his mouth, snapped at me with vicious teeth no human child had, and made a suggestion to me no human child would, and I backed hastily away, cursing myself for allowing emotion to fog my mind. Danny had said some of the Unseelie were imprisoning children. With that awful thought in mind, I'd looked into the Silver and seen its denizens colored by my fear and worry, which had airbrushed telling clues. If I'd been thinking clearly, I would have noticed the subtle wrongness in the shape of the children's heads, the unnatural ferocity in their tiny faces. I didn't spare a glance for the fourth mirror, but walked straight to the fifth. At a slight angle from it, so the LM wouldn't see me doing it, I snapped a picture, sent it to Barron's cell phone, then slid my phone into my pocket. Only then did I let the impact of the scene hit me. We had a definite destination. He was in my living room, at my house in Ashford, Georgia. The Lord Master had my mom and dad bound to chairs and gagged, with a dozen black and crimson-clad guards standing around them. The Lord Master was in my hometown. What had he done to it? Had he brought shades with him? Were Unseelie walking the streets even now, feeding off my friends? The one place I'd tried so hard to keep safe, and I'd failed. I'd let Valaine take me there, given in to my weakness, stood outside my own home. Was that the fatal act that drew the Lord Master's attention? Or had he always known and only now decided to make use of it? In the mirror across the 15 or so feet that separated us, my daddy shook his head. His eyes said, "Don't you dare, baby. You stay on that side of the mirror. Don't you dare trade yourself for us." How could I not? He was the one who'd taught me that the heart had reasons of which reason knew nothing, the only quote of Pascal's I remembered. All the reason in the world couldn't have talked me into turning away now, even if I hadn't had Barron's as backup. Even without a safety net, this was a wire I'd have walked. I might have found out my biological mother's name last night. I might have even begun thinking of myself as Mac O'Connor. But Jack and Rainey Lane were my mom and dad, and always would be. I walked to the wall. Daddy's eyes were wild now, and I knew, if not for the gag, he'd be roaring at me. I stepped up, into the Silver. Part 3. But now we see through a glass darkly, and the truth, before it is revealed to all, face to face, we see in fragments. Alas, how illegible! In the error of the world, so we must spell out its faithful signals, even when they seem obscure to us, and as if amalgamated with a will wholly bent on evil. Umberto Eco, The Name of the Rose. Chapter 30.
"Good of you to come,"
mocked the Lord Master.
"Nice hat."
Entering the Silver was like pressing forward into a gluey membrane. The surface rippled thickly when I touched it. When I tried to step into it, it resisted. I pushed harder, and it took considerable effort to force my boot to puncture the silvery skin. I thrust in up to my hip. Still, the mirror pressed back at me with a buoyant elasticity. For a moment, I stood half in each world, my face through the mirror, the back of my head in the house, one leg in the silver, one leg out. Just when I thought it would expel me with the snap of a giant rubber band, it yielded, sucked me in, warm and unpleasantly wet, and squirted me out on the other side, stumbling. I'd expected to find myself standing in the living room, but I was in a tunnel of sorts, of moist pink membrane. My living room was farther away than it had looked from outside the mirror. There were 40 or so feet between me and my parents. Barron's had been wrong. The L.M. was more adept with silvers than he'd thought. Not only was he capable of stacking silvers, the tunnel hadn't been at all visible from beyond the glass. In tennis speak, this set went to the L.M., but there was no way he was winning the match.
"As if I had a choice!"
I wiped my face with a sleeve, scrubbing at a thin layer of smelly, slippery afterbirth. It was dripping off my Mikhailo. I'd thought about removing it before I'd entered the mirror. It's a little hard for people to take you seriously when you're wearing one. But now I was glad I hadn't. It was no wonder people avoided the silvers.
"You had every choice," my dad's eyes said furiously. "You chose the wrong one."
My mother's eyes were saying way more than that. She began with the mess that was my tousled black hair sticking out from under my hat, went nearly ballistic over the tight leather pants I was wearing, made short, scathing work of my butchered nails, and by the time she got around to the automatic weapon that kept slipping around my shoulder, banging into my hip, I had to tune her out. I took a step forward.
"Not so fast,"
said the Lord Master.
"Show me the stones."
I swung my gun forward into my other hand, slipped the pack off my shoulder, opened it, fished out the black pouch and held it up.
"Get them out. Show them to me."
Barron's didn't think that was a good idea.
"I told you not to involve Barron's, and I don't give a fuck what he thinks."
"You told me not to bring him. I had to involve him. He's the one who had the stones. Have you ever tried to steal anything from Barron's?"
The look on his face said he had.
"If he interferes, they die."
"I got your message loud and clear the first time. He won't interfere."
I needed to get closer. I needed to be between the L.M. and his guards and my parents when Barron's and his men arrived. I needed to be in stabbing distance. Barron's planned to reconfigure his silver to connect to whatever destination the Lord Master was at, but he'd said it would take time, depending on the location.
"Stall,"
he'd ordered.
"Once I get the photo, I'll work on connecting to the other end. My men will come in behind you as soon as I have a lock on the location. Put down the spear, your gun, the pistol in the back of your pants, the switchblade in your sleeve, and the knives in your boots. Kick them all away."
How did he know where all my weapons were? My mother couldn't have looked more shocked if she'd found out I was sleeping with half the Ashford High football team and smoking crack between touchdowns. I gave her my most reassuring look. She flinched. Apparently what I considered reassuring lately came off a little savage, I guess.
"It's been a rough few months, Mom," I said defensively. "I'll explain it all later. Let my parents go," I told the L.M. "I'll cooperate fully. You have my word."
"I do not require your word. I have your last living relatives. Being of such finite duration, humans care deeply about such things. Alina told me her parents died in a car wreck when she was 15. Yet another lie. Makes one wonder, does it not? I would never have thought to look for them had you not led me here."
How had I led him here? How had he followed me to Ashford? Could he track Valaine? Was Valaine duplicitous? Working with the Lord Master?
"They're not my relatives," I said coolly.
"My relatives are dead. When you killed Alina, you wiped out the last of my line, except for me." I was hoping to make my parents' value seem a little less than it really was. It always worked in the movies.
"We were adopted."
I snatched a quick look at my mom, even though I knew I shouldn't. Her eyes shimmered with unshed tears. Great. She disapproved of everything about me, and now I'd hurt her feelings. I was batting 1,000. The Lord Master didn't say a word,
just walked over to my dad and slammed him in the face with his fist. My daddy's head snapped back and blood spurted from his nose. He gave a dazed shake and his eyes said, "Get out of here, baby." "All right," I shouted. "I lied. Leave him alone." The Lord Master turned back to me.
"Mortality is the consummate weakness. It shapes your entire existence, your every breath. Is it any wonder the Fae have always been gods to your kind?"
"Never to me."
"Drop your weapons."
I let my automatic slip to the ground, yanked the pistol from the back of my pants, dropped the switchblade from the cuff of my jacket, and extracted a knife from each boot.
"The spear."
I stared. If I tried to throw the spear the 40 feet that separated us, what good would it do? Even if I hit him dead in the heart, he was part human and wouldn't die right away. I had no doubt at least one of my parents would be dead seconds after I'd thrown it, if not both. "Stall," Barons had said. I pulled the spear from my holster and slid it from beneath my coat. The moment I uncovered it, it crackled and sparked, shooting jagged white charges into the air. Alabaster, it blazed with almost blinding luminosity, as if drawing power from the Fey realm around it. I couldn't make my hand let go of it. My fingers wouldn't unclench.
"Drop it now."
He turned toward my mother and drew back his fist. I snarled as I flung the spear away from me. It lodged in the wall of the sleek pink tunnel. The fleshy canal shuddered as if with pain. "Leave her alone," I gritted.
"Kick away the weapons and show me the stones."
"Seriously, Baron said not to."
"Now!"
Sighing, I withdrew the stones from the pouch and peeled back the velvet cloth they were wrapped in. The reaction was instantaneous and violent. The tunnel spasmed, moaning deep in its wet walls, and the floor shuddered beneath me. The stones blazed with blue-black light. The walls contracted and expanded, as if laboring to expel me, and suddenly I was blinded by baleful light, deaf to all but the rushing of wind and water. I squeezed my eyes shut against the glare. There was nothing to hold on to. I clutched the stones, trying to cover them, and nearly lost the velvet cloth to the gale. My backpack banged against my shins and was torn from my grasp. I howled into the wind, calling for my parents, for Barons, hell, even for the Lord Master. I felt like I was being ripped in 10 different directions. My coat was being torn from my shoulders, rippling in the hard breeze. I struggled to shove the stones back into the pouch. Abruptly, all was still.
"I told you,"
I growled, keeping my eyes closed, waiting for the retinal burn to fade.
"Barons advised against it, but did you listen? No."
There was no answer. "Hello?" I said warily. Still no answer. I opened my eyes. Gone was the pink, membranous canal. I stood in a hall of purest gold. Gold walls. Gold floors. I tipped my head back. Gold that stretched up as far as I could see. If there was a ceiling, it was beyond my vision. Soaring, towering golden walls to nowhere. I was alone. No Lord Master. No guards. No parents. I looked down, hoping to find my gun, knives, and backpack. There was nothing but smooth, endless gold floor. I glanced at the walls, searching frantically for my spear. There was no glint of alabaster to be found. In fact, I realized, as I turned in a slow circle, there was nothing on those gold walls at all except hundreds. No thousands, no... I stared. They went all the way up, vanishing beyond my vision. Billions of mirrors. Trying to absorb it, I tasted infinity. I was a minuscule dot on a linear depiction of time that stretched endlessly in both directions, rendering me of utter and absolute inconsequence. Oh, shit. 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 I knew where I was. The Hall of All Days. Chapter 31. I have no idea how long I sat. Time in this place would become an impossible thing for me to gauge. I sat in the middle of the Hall of All Days, knees tucked up,
staring down at the golden floor because looking around made me feel small and vertiginous, trying to take stock of my situation. Problem. Somewhere out there in the real world, in my living room in Ashford, Georgia, the Lord Master still had my parents. I imagined he was seriously pissed off. And it wasn't my fault. He was the one who'd insisted I show him the stones. I'd cautioned against it. But fault was as irrelevant as my presence in this vast, indifferent place of all days. He still had my parents. That was relevant. Hopefully, Barons was even now speeding his way to them through the reconfigured silver in his study, and hopefully his comrades were storming in through the mirror at 1247 LaRue. And, hopefully, that slippery pink tunnel that had too closely resembled a portion of the female anatomy for my comfort was still intact, and I had merely been expelled by its labor pains, and hopefully within moments my parents would be safe. That was four too many hopefullys for my taste. It didn't matter. I'd been effectively neutralized, plucked from the number set and tossed into the quantum hall of variables, none of which computed into the only equation I understood and cared about. There were billions of mirrors around me, billions of portals, and I had a tough time choosing between 15 shades of pink. After a while, I checked my watch. It was stuck at 1:14 p.m. I slipped off my coat and began to strip, tucking the pouch containing the stones in my waistband. The hall was too warm for the layers I was wearing. I removed my sweater and long-sleeved knit jersey and tied them around my waist, then put my coat back on. I performed an inventory of items on my person. One knife, an antique Scottish dirk that the L.M. hadn't known about, pilfered from the baubles portion of Baron's books and strapped to my left forearm. One baby food jar full of wriggling, unsealy flesh in my left coat pocket. Two protein bars tucked into an inner coat pocket, squished. One Makalo, still strapped beneath my chin. One cell phone. I took inventory of what I didn't have. No batteries or flashlights. No water. No spear. I stopped there. That was bad enough. I pulled my cell phone from my back pocket and punched up Baron's number. I've become so accustomed to his invincibility that I expected it to ring, and when it didn't, I was flabbergasted. Apparently even his cell service had dead spots, and if it wasn't going to work somewhere, I could understand it not working here. Even if I'd had Valaine's name, I doubted it would have worked in this place. My own mind nearly didn't work here. The longer I sat, the odder I began to feel. The hall wasn't merely the confluence of infinite doorways to alternate places and times. The many portals made the hall live and breathe, ebb and flow. The hall was time. It was ancient and young, past and present and future all in one. BB&B exuded a sense of spatial distortion from harboring a single silver in Baron's study. These billions of mirrors, opening onto the same hall, created an exponentially compounded effect, both spatially and temporally. Time here wasn't linear. It was... My mind couldn't focus on it. But I was part of it, and I didn't get that at all. I didn't matter. I was essential. I was a child. I was a withered old woman. I was death. I was the source of all creation. I was the hall, and the hall was me. A tiny bit of me seemed to bleed into every doorway. Duality didn't begin to describe it. Like this place itself, I was all possibles. It was the most terrifying feeling I'd ever felt. I tried IYCGM. No service. I stared at IYD for a long time. Riordan had said he'd kill me if I used it when I didn't need it. My first thought was, I'd like to see him get here and try. My second thought was that I wouldn't, because then he'd be here too, and he really might kill me. I couldn't begin to present a convincing argument that I was dying. I might not like my current situation, but there was no arguing that I was in perfect health, with no apparent threat to my life in the immediate vicinity. Although I seemed to be growing more confused by the moment. Memories from my childhood had begun to stir in my mind, seeming too vivid and tantalizing for mere memories. I skipped lightly over them, found one I liked. My 10th birthday. Mom and Dad had thrown a surprise party for me. The moment I chose to focus on it, it swelled with dramatic appeal. And there were my friends, laughing and holding presents. Real. So real, waiting for me to join them in the dining room where they were having cake and ice cream. I saw it all happening, right there in the molten gold of the floor I was staring down at. I traced my fingers over the vision. The gold rippled in the wake of my fingertips, and I was touching our dining room table, about to sink into it, slip inside my 10-year-old body in the chair, laughing at something Alina said. Alina was dead. This was not now. This was not real. I jerked my gaze away. In the air in front of me, a new memory took shape. My first shopping trip to Atlanta with my aunts. It had left a serious impression on me. We were in Bloomingdale's. I was 11. I wandered, staring up at all the pretty things, no longer seeing the gold walls and mirrors. I closed my eyes, stood, and shoved the cell phone into my back pocket. I had to get out of this place. It was messing with my mind. But where? I opened my eyes and began moving. The moment I did, the memories vanished from the air around me, and my mind was clear again. A thought occurred to me. Frowning, I walked a few yards and stopped. The memories resumed. My daddy was cheering at my first ever and last softball game. He'd bought me a pink mitt with magenta stitching. My mom had embroidered my name and flowers on it. The boys were laughing at me and my mitt. I ran to catch a ground ball to prove to them how tough I was. It popped up and slammed me in the face, bloodying my nose and chipping a tooth. I winced. They laughed harder, pointing. I manipulated the memory. Fast rewound, caught the ball perfectly, threw out the runner at home plate, and got it there in plenty of time for the catcher to take out the runner at third. The boys were awed by my ball-playing prowess. My daddy puffed with pride. It was a lie, but an oh-so-sweet one. I began walking again. The memory exploded into pink mitt dust and sprinkled the floor. Stopping in the hall was dangerous, perhaps even deadly. My suspicion was confirmed a short time later when I passed a skeleton sitting cross-legged on the floor, leaning back against the gold wall between mirrors. Its posture evidenced no sign of struggle, gave no hint of agony and death. The face of the skull had, inasmuch as a skull could, a peaceful look to its bones. Had it starved to death? Or had it lived 100 years, lost in dreams? I felt no hunger pangs, and should have, considering all I'd had since yesterday afternoon was coffee hours ago. Did one even need to eat here, where time wasn't what one expected at all? I began glancing into the mirrors as I passed. Some of the things in the mirrors glanced back, looking startled and confused. It seemed some of them could see me as clearly as I could see them. I was going to have to make a choice, and sooner was probably wiser than later. I was beginning to think gold was the most peaceful, right, perfect color I'd ever seen. And the floor, so inviting. Warm, smooth. I could stretch out and rest my eyes a bit, gather my strength for what was certain to be an arduous journey. First danger of the hall of all days, when you can live any day over again in your mind, and live it right, why leave it all? I could save my sister here, save the world, never know the difference after a while. Second danger of the hall of all days, when anything is possible, how do you choose? There were tropical vistas of white beaches that stretched for miles, with aqua waves so clear that coral reefs of rainbow hues shimmered through, glinting in the sun, and tiny silver fish leaped and played in the swells. There were streets of fabulous mansions, deserts and vast plains. There were ancient reptilian beasts in verdant valleys and post-apocalyptic cities. There were underwater worlds and silvers that opened directly onto open space, black and deep, glittering with stars. There were doorways to nebulae, and even one that led straight to the event horizon of a black hole. I tried to fathom the mind that would want to go there. An immortal that had done everything else? A fae that could never die and wanted to know what it felt like to be sucked up by one? The more I saw in the Hall of All Days, the more I understood that I understood nothing about the immortal race that had created this place. There were mirrors that opened onto images so terrible I looked away the instant I caught a glimpse of what was going on. We've done some of those things. Apparently other beings on other worlds have too. In one, a man performing a horrific experiment saw me, grinned, and lunged for me. I took off in a mad dash, heart pounding, and ran without stopping for a long, long time. Finally, I glanced behind me. I was alone. I concluded that silver must have been one way. Thankfully. I wondered if all the mirrors in the hall were, or if some of them still worked both ways. If I stepped through one, could I immediately return if I didn't like the world? From what Barons had told me, unpredictability was the name of the game in here. How had I gotten to the hall? What had the stones done to rip me from the tunnel of a set of silvers and dump me into the vortex of the entire network? Did they work as a homing beacon, and would uncovering them always bring me here? I walked. I looked away. Pain, pleasure, delight, torture, love, hate, laughter, despair, beauty, horror, hope, grief, all of it was available here in the Hall of All Days. There were the surreal mirrors, with Dali-esque landscapes, so similar to his paintings that I wondered if they hadn't been hung here and animated. There were doorways to dreamscapes so alien I couldn't even give name to what I was seeing. I looked into mirror after mirror, growing more uncertain by the moment. I had no idea if any of the portals actually opened into my world at all. Were they different planets? Different dimensions? Once I entered one, would I be committing to a perilous journey through an unbeatable maze? Billions. There were billions of choices. How was I ever going to find my way home? I walked for what felt like days. Who knows? It might have been. Time has no meaning in the hall. Nothing does. Tiny me. Huge corridor. An occasional skeleton, the rare human one. Silence except for the sound of my boots on gold. I began to sing. I went through every song I knew, staring into silvers, running from some. Then one stopped me cold in my tracks. I stared. Christian? I exploded disbelievingly. His back was to me as he walked through a dark forest, but the moon in his mirror was bright, and there was no mistaking his build and walk. Those long legs in faded jeans, the dark hair pulled back in a queue, the broad shoulders and confident gait. His head whipped around. There was a line of crimson and black tattoos down the side of his neck that hadn't been there the last time I'd seen him. Mac? His lips moved, but I couldn't hear him. I stepped closer. Is it really you? Apparently he could hear me. Elation and relief battled with anxiety in the gorgeous Scotsman's eyes. He stared at me, leaned closer, looked confused, then shook his head. No, Mac. Stay wherever you are. Don't come here. Go back.
I don't know how to go back.
Where are you?
Can't you see?
He shook his head. You seem to be inside a large cactus. For a moment, I thought you were here with me. How are you seeing me? I had to make him repeat it several times. I'm not the best lip reader. The word cactus threw me. I couldn't see a single cactus in the forest.
I'm in the Hall of All Days.
Tiger eyes flared.
Don't stay long. It messes with you. I kind of figured that out.
A moment ago, my pink mitt had reappeared in my hand, and I could hear the sounds of the ballpark around me. I began to jog in place. The hall was not fooled. The mitt remained on my hand. I jogged a tight circle in front of the mirror. Glove and memory vanished. It's a dangerous place. I was there for a time. I had to choose a silver. I chose badly. They are not what they seem. What they show you is not where they lead.
Are you kidding me?
I nearly went ballistic. If I entered a tropical beach, would I end up in Nazi Germany with my highly inconvenient black hair? The one I chose didn't. I've been jumping dimensions ever since, trying to get to better places. Some of the silvers are true, some are not. There's no way to tell which.
But you're a lie detector!
It doesn't work in the hall, lass. It only works out of it, and not always. I doubt any of your she-seer talents work there, either. Still jogging a tight circle, I shut my eyes and sought that place in the center of my mind. Show me what is true, I commanded. I opened my eyes and looked back at Christian. He still stood in a dark forest.
Where are you?
In a desert. He gave me a bitter smile.
With four suns and no night. I'm badly burned. I've had nothing to eat or drink in too long. If I don't find a dimensional shift soon, I'm in trouble.
A dimensional shift? I asked if he meant an IFP and explained what they were. He nodded.
They abound, but they have no been abounding here.
Aboundin', he'd said, although the mirror was showing me a perfectly clean, well-rested man. Now that I knew what to look for, I could see his exhaustion and strain. More than that, I was picking up a certain grim acceptance.
From Christian McKeltar?
No way.
How bad off are you, Christian? I said. And don't lie to me.
He smiled. I seem to recall saying the same to you once. Have you slept with him?
Long story. Answer my question.
That's a yes.
Ah, lass.
Tiger Eyes held mine for a tense, probing moment.
Bad, he said finally.
Are you actually even standing there? I mean, up on your own feet? Was anything I was seeing remotely true?
No, lass. Could you stand if you wanted to? I said sharply.
Not sure. I didn't waste another moment. I stepped into the mirror. Chapter 32. Some silvers feel like quicksand. They don't like to let you go. I expected this one to behave like the one hanging in the LM's house, hard to push into, certain to expel me with a rubbery snap. It was hard to push into, more resistant than the first one, but it proved even more difficult to get out of. Without Christian, I might not have made it. I found myself trapped inside silvery glue that held my limbs nearly immobile. I kicked and punched and ended up getting so turned around that I had no idea which way was out. Apparently, there was only one direction that would work. Then Christian's hand was on my arm. He could stand, and I shoved toward him with all my strength. The college back home where I take classes part-time has a wind tunnel created by the unique placement of the math building breezeway and the science buildings around it. On especially windy days, it's almost impossible to cut through it. You have to lean forward at a precarious angle as you pass the math building, head ducked, forging ahead with all your might. I learned the hard way about breakpoints, where either a design flaw or a joke by some pissed-off engineer leaves an eye in the breezeway, where the wind abruptly stops. If you're unaware of it and still forging ahead, you fall flat on your face in front of all the math and science geeks, who know about it and loiter in the general vicinity on windy days, but don't tell freshmen because that would deprive them of the endless amounts of amusement they get from watching us wipe out, preferably in a short skirt that ends up around our waist. That was this silver. I shoved toward the hand, fighting, pressing with all my might, and abruptly the resistance gave way, and I went flying out of the glass into Christian at such velocity that we went rolling and tumbling across sand. I tried to gasp, but it didn't work. I was in a blast furnace. It was so bright that I couldn't open my eyes. The air was so hot and dry that I couldn't breathe. I struggled to acclimate and finally sucked down a breath that seared my lungs. I slitted my eyes, got a good look at Christian, and rolled off him. He was worse than bad off. He was in serious danger. With his dark complexion, he'd tanned, but there was a cruel redness to it. His lips were cracked, and I could tell by his eyes and skin that he was severely dehydrated. Blisters covered his face. I whirled around, hoping to find a mirror hanging in the air behind me through which I could drag us to safety. There wasn't one. There were, however, hundreds of man-sized cactuses, any one of which might have been the one he said I'd appeared to be standing in. Was there a mirror camouflaged inside one of them? It stood to reason that on worlds the Fae wanted to visit unobserved, they'd have had to conceal the silver in something if there was no place it didn't appear utterly incongruous with the terrain. Or had Cruce's mysterious curse screwed things up? I wondered if I should try flinging myself into a few of the nearest cactuses, employing the same method Danny had used to try to break through wards, hoping for a two-way portal. The thought held little appeal. She'd gotten nothing but badly bruised for her efforts. The cactuses sported a protective armor of needle-sharp spines. Squinting, I glanced around. We were in an ocean of desert. It had to be 115 degrees, no shade anywhere to be seen, nothing but sand. I looked up and instantly regretted it. The sky was painfully bright with 4 blazing suns. It was whiter than white. It was radioactive white.
"You bloody damned fool,"
Christian managed through split lips.
"Now we'll both be dying here."
"No, we won't. Which, cactus did I come through?"
"I've no bloody idea. And those spines are poisonous, so good luck poking around at them."
Damn. On to Plan B, which was basically a wing and a prayer. I began to remove the black pouch from my waistband, preparing to uncover the stones. Would they return us to the hall where we could choose the next portal together? Who knew? Who cared? Anything was better than this. He would die here, and so would I. I rolled close to Christian and pressed against him.
"Ugh. And now you flirt me up, lass,"
he said weakly, with a shadow of that killer smile.
"When I canna do a thing about it."
"Wrap your arms and legs around me, Christian. Don't let go. No matter what happens, don't let go." Sweat was pouring down my face, dripping from beneath my mech halo into my eyes, pooling between my breasts. I was wearing too many clothes, a bike helmet and a leather coat in a desert. He didn't question me. Just wrapped his legs around my hips and locked his hands in the small of my back. I prayed he had enough strength to keep his grip. I had no idea what was going to happen, but I didn't expect it to be gentle. I slid the pouch from between us, loosened the drawstring, and uncovered the tips of the stones. They flared to life, pulsing with blue-black fire. The terrain responded instantly and violently, just as the pink tunnel did. The desert began to undulate, and the air was filled with a high-pitched whine that quickly turned into a metallic-sounding scream. Sand whipped up, stinging my hands and face.
"Are you crazy? What the—"
The rest of Christian's words were lost in the howling wind. The atomic white sky darkened to blue-black in dramatic, quick increments. I looked up. The suns were being eclipsed, one by one. The sand shuddered beneath us. Swells rose, dips formed. Christian and I rolled, down, down, deep into a sandy valley that was still forming as we tumbled. I felt brackets snapping off my mech-halo. I was suddenly afraid the desert would swallow us alive. But the desert didn't want us. That was the whole point, although I didn't know it then. I struggled to keep my grip on the pouch, clutched it tightly to my chest. Christian's legs were steel around my hips, his hands locked. The temperature dropped sharply. The desert began to tremble. The tremble became a rumble. The rumble became an earthquake, and just when I thought we might be shaken to pieces, the ground beneath us sank abruptly, then gave a single gigantic heave and flung us straight up into the air. As we went soaring into the dark sky, I muttered an apology to Christian. He sort of laughed and muttered back in my ear that he preferred a quick death by falling, with crushed bones and all, to a slow death by dehydration. And at least it was nice and cool, finally, but maybe, since it seemed the stones had triggered the cataclysmic reaction, I might try covering them back up and see what happened. I shoved them in the pouch and crammed it down the waistband of my pants. We fell. I braced for impact. Chapter 33. We splashed down into icy water. I plunged deep. Kicking hard, I surfaced and inhaled greedily. I blinked water from my eyes and saw that we'd fallen into a stone quarry. How lucky! That must mean a terrifying monster with razor-sharp teeth was in the water beneath me, about to snap my legs off, because the gods didn't smile on me, at least not lately, or that I was aware of. And Christian wasn't as bad off as I'd thought, because he was swimming toward shore. I narrowed my eyes. Toward shore, leaving me to my own devices that, as far as he knew, might involve drowning. I checked to make sure the pouch was still in my waistband and kicked into a breaststroke. I'm a strong swimmer, and I pulled myself out of the quarry just a few seconds after he did. He collapsed hard on the grass-covered bank and closed his eyes.
"Thanks for sticking around to make sure I wasn't drowning." Then I murmured, "Oh, Christian."
I touched his blistered face, made sure he was breathing, took his pulse. He was unconscious. It had taken the last ounce of energy he possessed to get himself out of the quarry. First things first. Were we safe here? I scanned our surroundings. The quarry was large and deep, overflowing here and there into smaller ponds and pools. It occupied a small corner of a huge valley. Miles and miles of grassy plain were surrounded by moderate mountains with ice-capped crowns. The valley was peaceful and calm. At the opposite edge, animals grazed serenely. It looked like we were safe, at least for now. I heaved a sigh of relief and struggled out of my wet leather coat. I slipped the pouch containing the stones from my waistband and set it aside. There was no doubt about it. Removing the stones from the spelled pouch made dimensions shift for some reason, but while uncovered, they seemed to wreak total havoc on the world around them. The next time we used them, I'd flash them quickly, and maybe we'd get to skip the whole violent expulsion motif and glide at a gentle tempo into the next world. After a brief hesitation, I stripped down to bra and panties, grateful for the moderate climate. Wet leather sucks. I draped my clothing on nearby rocks to dry in the sun, hoping the leather wouldn't shrink to ridiculous sizes. Next concern, what to do for Christian? He was breathing shallowly, and his pulse was erratic. He'd passed out in the sun, where his burn would deepen. The blisters on his face were crusted and seeping blood. How long had he been in that hellish desert? When had he last eaten? There was no way I could move him. I couldn't even get him out of his wet clothes. I could cut them off, but he'd need them again. Who knew what we might have to face next? He was more heavily muscled than last I'd seen him, and unconscious he was dead weight. Had he been fighting his way through dimension after dimension since Halloween? Did time pass the same way where he'd been? Unless it had fallen out, I had a baby food jar of unseely flesh in my coat. I tripped over my own feet in my haste to get to it, and unbuttoned pocket after pocket, searching.
Ow!
I'd found it, wriggling wetly in shards of broken bottle, buttoned in an inner pocket. I extracted the flesh carefully from the jar, which must have shattered in my tumble across the sand. Of the 7 strips I'd crammed into the tiny container, there were 4 left. 3 of them had wriggled off somewhere. I held the noxious pieces of gray rhino boy flesh, picked out slivers of glass, and considered the rapidly healing cuts on my fingers. Was I healing so well because of the unseelie I'd eaten in the past? Did it cause permanent changes, as Rowan acclaimed? Would it do something terrible to Christian? I had no idea what else to do for him. I had only 2 protein bars, and I didn't know if the water around us was drinkable or contaminated by some deadly-to-humans parasite. I'd never been a Girl Scout, couldn't start a fire with sticks, had no container to boil water, even if I could, and was disgusted to realize I was still, in many ways, remarkably useless. I hurried back to his side, lay one of the strips on a flat stone, and cut it up into pieces as small as early peas. I pried open his teeth, stuffed the pieces in, and held his mouth and nose closed, hoping the flesh would, in dim-witted rhino boy fashion, wriggle toward his stomach, seeking escape. It did. I wasn't so useless after all. He gagged. I released my hold on his nose, and his throat muscles convulsed. He gagged again and swallowed involuntarily. He coughed and made a retching sound. Even when you're unconscious, unsealy meat is revolting. With a groan, he rolled over onto his side. I diced another strip, stuffed it into his mouth, and held it closed again. This time he resisted, but his body was still too weak to put up much of a fight. By the time I got the third strip sliced up and in his mouth, he'd rolled over onto his back again, opened his eyes, and was looking at me. I think he was trying to ask what I was doing, but I clamped his teeth together with one hand on the top of his head and the other beneath his chin. He gagged instead and swallowed again. The effects of unsealy flesh on an injured human body are instantaneous and miraculous. As I watched, his blisters disappeared, and his color returned to normal, leaving him lightly tanned. The gauntness in his face vanished, and the epidermis on his body plumped everywhere, erasing the damage of dehydration, rebuilding him from the inside out. Unsealy flesh is potent and addictive. Even though I was cured of my little obsession with it, did he really need that last strip? I envied what I knew was happening to him, the heady rush of power surging hot through his veins, heightening his hearing, smell, and vision, increasing his strength to Baron's levels, filling him with a euphoric sense of invincibility and an exquisitely elevated awareness of his own body in relation to its surroundings. Yes, he was certainly getting better. Tiger eyes were not only open but moving with unabashed appreciation over the skin bared by my bra and underwear. He pushed my hand off his mouth. Quickly, and possibly in large part because I was tempted to eat it myself, I knelt over him and shoved the last strip between his lips. He sat up so fast our heads banged, hard. I yelped, and he spat. Unsealy flesh went flying from his mouth and flopped on the ground between us. He looked at the animated piece of meat, then looked at me, and I'm not sure what he found more disgusting, the smelly gray flesh with oozing pustules, or me for putting it in his mouth in the first place. It pissed me off because even on my worst day, I was preferable to unsealy flesh. The absence of heat in those amber eyes was downright chilling. "You might try thanking me," I said stiffly. He gagged again, cleared his throat, turned, and spat over his shoulder.
"What?"
he said, turning back to me and pointing.
"The bloody hell is that?"
"Unsealy flesh," I said coolly.
"That's unsealy! You fed me the flesh of a dark fae!"
"How do you feel, Christian?" I demanded. "Pretty good?" He certainly looked good, sitting there in faded jeans, wet t-shirt straining over his wide shoulders, muscles rippling in his arms as he slicked wet hair back from his face. No burns, no blisters, no hunger or thirst. Has it occurred to you that I saved your ass?
"At what cost? What does eating it do to you? Nothing fae is without price."
"It heals you. Would you rather I hadn't?"
"Big, huge lie in there. There are drawbacks. What are they?"
he pushed furiously. "There are drawbacks to everything," I snapped. We glared at each other. "Would you rather I'd let you die?"
"Did you even try anything else first? Or are you all about magic, instant gratification?"
I leapt to my feet and began pacing. "What would you have had me try? Dragging your big body into the shade all by myself so you wouldn't get burned worse? How about figuring out how to start a fire with twigs?" "No, I have it." I whirled around and shot him a look. "I should have gone looking for a convenience store for sunblock and aloe gel, and then when I found that, set off for a vet so I could find you subcutaneous fluids like my neighbors give their sick cat." His mouth twitched.
"Nice outfit, Mac."
I bristled. I'd been stomping around in my bra and panties, and he found me amusing in my underwear. "My clothes are soaked," I growled.
I was speaking of your...
His gaze shot upward.
Would you be calling that a hat, lass?
I closed my eyes and groaned. I'd gotten so used to the weight of it on my head that I'd forgotten I was wearing my Mackalo. I unstrapped it, snatched it from my head, scraped off strands of dripping moss, and inspected it for damage. Two of the brackets were broken at the base, and several of the lights had been turned on in our roll down sand dunes, wasting precious batteries. I clicked them off and put the helmet on the rocks near my clothes. I nodded at the piece of unsealy lying on the ground between us. Are you going to eat that?
Not for love or money,
he said vehemently. Well, pick it up and put it in your pocket. You might need it again. Like it or not, it saved your life. No matter how badly I wanted it, I didn't dare impair my she-seer abilities. If we encountered anything fey, my nulling talents were all I had. We'd have to freeze them and run, or use the stones again.
It did something to me. Something wrong.
He studied it with distaste, picked it up, drew back his arm, and flung it into the quarry. I heard a splash, a second, much larger splash, and a snapping sound, followed by a third splash. Since my back was to the water, I had to interpret what happened from the look on his face. Something awful-looking ate it? Looking mildly shocked, he nodded.
Tell me everything you know about what you just fed me, and the effects it has. And as for the Loch Lass, I wouldn't recommend swimming in it.
Christian's clothes were soaked, and after a scan of the snow-covered peaks around us, he concluded there was a high probability of a sharp evening drop to frigid temperatures, which meant we needed our clothes dry, fast. As there was no convenient dryer nearby, toasting them in the sun was our only option, so a short time later we were both stretched out, me mostly naked, him completely. He was unselfconscious nude. I had to admit he had reason to be. After a quick glance, I'd sought privacy on the other side of the tumble of rocks our clothes were drying on, and savored the warmth on my skin. All that was missing was my iPod. And my parents, and my sister, and any feeling of normalcy or safety. In a nutshell, everything was missing. I was terrified for Mom and Dad. Since the silver I'd entered didn't show the tunnel from the outside, what assurance did I have that the destination it did show wasn't also an illusion? What if the LM wasn't holding my parents captive in my own living room, but someplace else, and I'd sent Barons on a wild goose chase with the photo I'd texted? A wave of frantic helplessness was building inside me, threatening to turn tidal. I didn't dare give in to panic. I had to stay calm and focused and work on moving forward however I could, even if it meant taking baby steps. Right now, that meant getting my clothes dry and resting while I had the chance. Who knew what dangers the night or even the next few hours might hold? Christian and I talked while we sunned, our voices carrying easily over the rocks between us. I told him about the effects of eating unsealy. He questioned me extensively, wanting to know who else had eaten it, exactly what it had done to them, and how long it had lasted. He seemed especially interested in the increased skill in the dark arts. "Speaking of dark arts," I said, "what did you guys do the night of the ritual? What happened? What went wrong?" He groaned.
"Oh, I take it that means the walls came down anyway. I've been trying to convince myself that my uncle's managed a miracle. Tell me everything, Mag. What's happened in the world while I've been stuck here?"
I told him that the walls had crashed completely at midnight, that I'd watched the Unseelie come through, and that the Lord Master and his princes had captured me at dawn. I omitted the rape, being turned pariah, and my subsequent, recovery. No way I was talking to the lie detector about those events, and told him merely that I was rescued by Danny and the She-Seers. I brought him up to speed on Jane's efforts, filled him in on what we'd learned about Iron, and told him that his family was okay and searching for him. I told him the book was still loose, but withheld the gruesome details of my recent encounter with it.
How did you come to be in the Hall of All Days?
I told him about the Lord Master abducting my parents, luring me into the silver and insisting that I show him the stones.
What an idiot! Even we know better than to do that. And he was once Fae.
It's no wonder the Queen appointed us Keltar Keepers of the Lore. We know more about their history than they do.
Because they keep drinking from the cauldron and forgetting?
Aye.
Well, at least we have them. Even though the ride's rocky, they help in a pinch.
Are you daft, Mac?
He said sharply. What do you mean?
Don't you know what's happening every time you take them out of that pouch?
Duh, that's what I'm saying. It makes us shift worlds, or dimensions, or whatever they are.
Because the realm we're in is trying to spit us out,
he said flatly.
The stones are anathema to the silvers. Once you remove them from your pouch, the realm detects them, and like an infected splinter endeavors to expel them. The only reason you go with them is because you're holding on to them.
Why are they anathema to the silvers?
Because of Kruse's curse.
You know what Kruse's curse was? Finally, someone who could tell me.
I've been wandering worlds in this place for what feels like bloody forever, and I've learned a thing or two. Kruse hated the Unseelie King for many reasons, and coveted his concubine. He cursed the Silvers to prevent the King from ever entering them again. He planned to take all the worlds inside the Silvers and the concubine for himself, be king of all the realms. But a curse is an immensely powerful thing, and Kruse cast it into a vortex of unfathomable power. Like most things, Fae, it took on a life of its own, transmuted. Some say you can still hear the words of it, sung softly on a dark wind, ever-changing.
Did he succeed in keeping the king from his concubine?
Aye. And because those stones you carry were carved from the king's fortress and bear the taint of him, the silvers reject them as well. A short time after that, the king was betrayed. He and the queen battled, and he killed the silly queen.
Was that when the concubine killed herself?
Aye.
Well, if the silvers are trying to spit us out, then won't they eventually send us back to our world? He snorted.
They aren't trying to spit us out back to where we came from, Mac. They're trying to restore the natural order of things and spit the stones back to where they came from.
I inhaled sharply. You mean every time we use them, whatever realm we're in is trying to send us to the Unseelie prison? What happens? Do they miss?
I suspect none of the realms has enough power on its own, so we're being swept toward it like a broom across a vast floor, through as many dimensions as possible.
Each time we get pushed a little closer?
Exactly.
Well, maybe... I tried hard to be optimistic. We're a million realms away. Somehow I didn't think so.
And maybe,
he said darkly,
we're one. And the next time you shift us, we'll end up face to face with the Unseelie King. Don't know about you, but I'd rather not meet the million-year-old creator of the worst of the Fae. Some say merely gazing on him in his true form will destroy your mind.
Sometime later, Christian announced our clothes were dry. I listened to his clothing rustle as he dressed. When he was done, I got up and moved toward my clothes, then stopped dead in my tracks, staring at him. He gave me a bitter smile.
I know. It started happening shortly after you fed it to me.
I'd seen him nude. I knew he had crimson and black tattoos on his chest, part of his abdomen, and up the side of his neck. But the rest of his body had been unmarked. It was no longer. Now his arms were covered with black lines and symbols, moving just beneath his skin.
It's spreading down my legs and moving up my chest,
he said. I opened my mouth, but didn't have the faintest idea what to say. I'm sorry I fed it to you to save your life. Do you wish I hadn't? Isn't it better to live, to fight another day, no matter what?
It's something to do with the dark arts part of it. I feel it surging in me like a storm.
He sighed heavily.
I suspect it's because of what Berens and I tried to do on Hallow's Eve.
And what was that? I fished.
Called on something ancient that we should have let slumber. Invited it. I keep hoping I'll find him, but once we were sucked into the vortex, we got separated.
I stared. Berens got sucked into the silvers with you on Halloween? Christian nodded.
We were both in the stone circle. Then it vanished, and so did we. We flashed from one landscape to the next like someone was flipping channels. Then suddenly I was in the Hall of All Days, and he wasn't. I may not care for the man, but he knows his dark magic.
I've been hoping we can find a way out, if we both put our minds to it.
I hate to break it to you, but he already has. Christian's eyes flared, then narrowed.
Behrens is out? Since when?
Since 4 days after Halloween, and he never said a word about it. He told me you were the only one who vanished that night.
How the bloody hell did he make it out?
I gave him a look of helpless exasperation. How would I know? He never even admitted he'd been here. He lied. Christian's eyes narrowed further.
When did you have sex with him?
Uh-oh. The lie detector was staring out at me from those tiger eyes. It wasn't like I was willing, I prevaricated.
Lie,
he said flatly. I wouldn't have done it under any other circumstances. That was the truth, and he could choke on it.
Lie.
Really? He made me do it.
Major, huge lie,
he said dryly. You don't understand the situation I was in.
Try me.
I hardly think it's relevant to any of our problems. I turned my back on him and began dressing.
Do you have feelings for him, Mac?
I dressed in silence.
Are you afraid to answer me?
I finished dressing and turned around. Christian was getting a little scary looking. His eyes were growing inhumanly brilliant, golden. I kept my face a smooth mask. I'm starved, I told him. I've got 2 protein bars. You can have one. And I'm thirsty, but I'd rather not drink from that quarry. And I think we have much bigger problems than my feelings about Jericho Behrens. Or lack thereof. And those animals, I pointed to the far edge of the valley, look edible to me. I began to walk. Unfortunately, we weren't the only ones that thought the sleek, graceful, gazelle-like creatures looked edible, as we soon discovered in the middle of the valley. A stampeding herd of thousands of shaggy-furred, horned bulls with whip-like tails and wolfish snouts was bearing down on us, hard.
Do you think maybe they'll just part around us?
I'd seen it happen in the movies.
I'm not sure it's not us they're after, Mac. Run!
I ran, even though I was pretty sure it was pointless. They were too fast, and we were too far from any kind of shelter.
Can't you do something, Druidy?
I shouted over the nearly deafening pounding of hooves. He gave me a look.
Druidry,
he shouted.
Requires preparation, or it can have disastrous results.
Well, you're looking all formidable. Surely you can do something with whatever's happening to you.
The black symbols had begun to move up his throat now. The ground was shaking so hard it was getting difficult to run. It felt like an earthquake creeping up on us. When I stumbled, Christian moved so quickly that the next thing I knew I was over his shoulder, and he was running 10 times faster than a normal man. Of course, he was pumped on Unseelie. I raised my head. The herd was too close. We still weren't moving fast enough. The creatures were gaining, snouts snapping, saliva flying. I could practically feel their breath blasting us.
Use the stones!
Christian shouted.
You said it was too dangerous!
Anything's better than dead, Mac!
I dug into my waistband, pulled out the pouch, and flashed the stones. Comparatively speaking, it was one of the smoother transitions. Unfortunately, it deposited us on a fire world. I flashed the stones again, and the flames on my boots died instantly, because the next world didn't support carbon-based life, and there was no oxygen. I flashed the stones again, and we were underwater. The 4th time I flashed them, we ended up on the narrowed top of a jagged cliff that fell sharply to a bottomless chasm on both sides.
Put me down!
I shouted over the wild gale whipping around us. I was crushed over Christian's shoulder, dripping wet and gasping for breath.
Here?
Yes, here!
Snorting, he lowered me to my feet, but kept his grip tight on my waist. I stared at him. His amber irises were rimmed with black. It was staining inward, like ink clouding water. The strange symbols were licking up over his jaw.
Just what did you do on Halloween?
Why was Unseelie flesh having such a strange effect on him? He gave me that killer smile, but it wasn't killer charming. It was killer cold.
I chickened out at the last minute, or we wouldn't have failed.
We tried to raise the only other power we knew of that had once stood against the Tuatha De and held its own. An ancient sect called the Dragaar raised it once, long ago. Barons didn't hesitate. I did. Care to get us off this cliff, Mac?
He snarled. What if the next place is even worse?
Keep shifting and I'll keep holding on.
A gust of air blasted us. We went stumbling off the edge into yawning darkness. I opened the pouch as we fell. A massive vortex exploded around us, black, swirling, tearing at my hair and clothes. I struggled to shove the stones back into the rune-covered bag. I could feel Christian's grip slipping, then his hands were gone, and I was alone. I slammed down onto grassy tundra on my hands and knees. I hit so hard, the pouch went flying from my hands. My forehead smacked into the earth, and I bit my tongue viciously. I couldn't feel Christian's hands on me anywhere. Ears ringing from the impact, I lifted my head, dazed. I stared straight into the eyes of an enormous wild boar with razor-sharp tusks. Chapter 34. When you're staring death in the face, time has a funny way of slowing down. Or maybe in this realm it really did move slower, who knows? All I knew as I stared into the boar's beady, cunning, hungry eyes, tiny in its cow-sized body, was that ever since I'd dropped my cell phone into our swimming pool, I'd begun losing things, one after another. First my sister.